plus IRDA. I started this project using the built-in infrared on my laptop. And originally, I started actually writing code under FreeBSD to examine infrared signals. But I then came across Lurk and switched to Linux for this experimentation. And it's a very good tool, which we'll talk about in more detail. So why do I bother? Infrared, as I say, it's all around, and I think it's very unlikely to be replaced. So any work that I do is going to continue to be interesting. The reason it's not going to be replaced is because it's fit for use. It actually works very well for what it does in most cases. It's very cheap, it's easy, it's simple, and basically the manufacturers are not going to fix it. If it, you know, it's doing its job, why change it? And because it's there, I think if you're in the security business, security is partly a state of mind, and it's being inquisitive about things, being aware of security and insecurity all around you every day. So I spend a lot of time in my work in hotels, and hotels are full of interesting distributed security problems, and infrared is one of them. So, you know, as I say, practice your art, play with what you're good at, know your enemy. The enemy in this case is bad security. You know, they say train hard, fight easy. So, infrared, because it's invisible, they think they can do anything. Doesn't matter what the signal's actually sending. They can use really simple codes. Once you've got the right code, they give you total control. There's no authentication. There's no back channel. There's no two-way connection. You basically send the code, you're God. They also, in a lot of cases, have an inverted security model. And what I mean by that is the security is entirely at the client end. So you have a server with some stuff on it they're trying to protect, but they secure it by putting the security into the device that you have control of. So, for example, in a hotel, the door reader is the thing that makes the decision. They're not necessarily sending any data to the door. They give you a card. That card tells the door to open. So the control is in your hands. The same is true with infrared TV systems. The TV itself is the filter, is the security mechanism, and that's at the wrong end. That's at the client end. So it's something, you know, you look at that and you think, well, how does that apply in the commercial world where I'm looking at an actual security issue? Have we done the same mistake? Okay, so for actual attacks, there's the obvious simple replay attacks. You just record a code and you retransmit it. And those apply to early car locking systems, garage doors, single code systems. The new RoboSapien toy is a good example of an infrared controlled toy, which actually, I don't know if they have them over here, but they're really cool toys. They're designed to be hacked. They're worth playing with. Break them open. There's all sorts of extra sensors inside that aren't attached and you can play with. Standard TVs, obviously bars, you know, they have those big screen TVs and stuff. And if you can get your hands on a special remote, a lot of these things have a master control, and there have in the past been distributions of those codes that people have got hold of the master remote and they've distributed the codes. So because there is no challenge response, it's just if you know the code, send it. So if you can get hold of a special remote, make a quick copy of it. So the tools you need to do that, it's a number of learning remotes. Pop into Saturn and you'll find a whole bunch of them. Casio IR watches, very early little low-powered watches you could program. Apple Newton was one of the earliest PDAs to have this capability. And in fact, there's a guy in the audience probably somewhere, Lars Imisch, who wrote one of the early applications that used that, which was very cool. Omni Remote, obviously everyone knows that. And now they have a developer's library, so you can build your own applications with IR capabilities. And you can get that from Pacific Neotech. Philips Pronto. Philips have standardized the format for representing the code. So the IR codes that we're going to look at have standardized representation, which many of the tools now recognize. So the Omni Remote, in fact, now supports the Pronto format. So you have a variety of tools you can use. So here's an example of a replay attack. There was a guy at DEF CON this year walking around with a RoboSapien, and he was trundling it around the audience, and he was trying to sell it because he'd bought it, thought it was cool. It was time to go home, didn't want to take it with him. So I followed him around for a bit and then sat down nearby and replayed the command. So basically, he stopped controlling the robot, and I controlled it instead. So I got to tag it. This guy parked outside my office. He's actually a co-worker, so he wasn't entirely underhand. But in the green car behind, I placed my receiver, and when he left that evening, I recorded his unlock code. And the following day, I was able to open his car for him before he left. Now, luckily for him, he has, as well as the car key on the right, which has the built-in infrared, he also has an alarm system, which is RF. So he's not entirely vulnerable, but we could get the door open. And we'll talk more about RF a bit later. Okay, so those are simple replay attacks. Well, that's all very well, but if you can't get hold of the original code, what do you do? So potentially, if you can represent codes in human-readable form, you should be able to invent your own and send them. So if you can analyze an example of the kind of code you're going for, then you know potentially the range that you can apply. So devices that are susceptible to that are things like garage doors, where it's a single code, but it's settable either by the shop or by yourself. So you have a number of choices which code you're going to use. TVs, we will come onto in more detail, and again, cars. So the tools for brute forcing, I've already mentioned Lurk. Lurk is a very nice tool because it not only gives you human-readable data, but it also has some good visualization tools. So you can actually see the image of the infrared that you're the signal that you're going to attack, which I personally find very helpful to be able to visualize what we're actually dealing with. It's software only. You can download it for Linux, use your built-in infrared. It only runs on Linux, as far as I'm aware. There's a device called IR Trans, which is a USB infrared device, which is Lurk compatible, also has its own software. You can get a serial version or a USB version. It's a more powerful transmitter, so you're not limited by the power of your built-in IR port. Runs on Linux, and that other one, what's it called? Something Mr. Gates did. And that's an IR Trans. Okay, so here's an example. We have a garage door opener, and it has a dip switch. Sort of there. And on that dip switch, you set a unique code for your building. So when you get issued the remote, you can be next door to someone else who has the same system, and you're not going to be opening each other's garage doors. Unless, of course. So this is X-Mode 2. It's a tool that comes with Lurk, and basically you point your remote at your infrared, and it reads the signal and shows you the pulses that are being sent. So this is what I mean by being useful for analysis. So we can see on the left, we've got the signal. It's basically the same signal repeated twice. So here I've set all 8 switches to on, and I've inferred that those are the 8 pulses that result. And we can check that by switching them all to off and then comparing. So we have a long pulse for on and a short pulse for off. And then play around with different settings, first switch on, last switch on, and so on. And we can see there's a corresponding change in the pattern according to what the switches are set to. So the conclusion is that we have a static start bit, 8 bits of data, and then 4 stop bits. So now we create an ASCII text file. This is a standard lurk config file, which has the various commands represented in ASCII. Now, this is the code that I knew opened the door because it was my remote. So that's the position the switch is in when I started. It turns out that the switch was soldered on upside down, so on is off and off is on. So E3 is actually that inverted to that. So now we've got human-readable format of a device that we potentially want to try and find all the codes for. So we write a script that just spits out a code for each possible value. We know there's 256 possible codes. It's an 8-bit sequence. So we just spit out in the same format all 256 codes, create a lurk config file, and fire it up. We then write another little one-liner which basically sends every code to the receiver. So it took 54 seconds standing in front of the receiver to send all 256 possible codes. So here we are in the garage. I fire up the laptop, start sending. Now, it wasn't a fantastic test because it's a foregone conclusion. I know when I hit code E3, the door's going to open. But to my surprise, I got to code 27 or so, and the door opened. And I didn't really understand why. And at first I thought, okay, there's an engineer back door that they use this. They have their own remote. But then I noticed, actually, they'd fitted a second receiver. So this is the original, and then there's a new one there. And basically, they had the company that installed that one went bust, and when they needed some more remotes, the company that sold it to them said, oh, well, you'll need a whole new system. So instead of selling them some compatible remotes, they sold them a whole secondary system. So that was kind of cool because that proved that the brute force did actually work. I'd managed to open the door using a code I was previously unaware of. Okay, so then we look at TV codes. Now, TV, as you can see, have much, much longer and more complex codes. Now, this is not because they're trying to improve security. They do this for other reasons. And the main reason is manufacturer collision avoidance. You don't want your Sony TV turning off when you switch off your video recorder by Grundig or whoever. They also have codes that represent the type of device. So the lead-in section here is manufacturer codes. And then you've got a section which is device types or other codings. And then you've got the actual command. So on your single remote, you might have TV, video, satellite. You've got a group of standard commands like channel select, menu buttons, left, right, up, down, teletext. And then you may have extra commands. If you're in a hotel using a standard TV, there may be a section of buttons that wouldn't appear on a normal remote. So they give them a different set of codes. And the kind of hidden codes that you might find, internal ones. In a lot of hotels, you'll see that the cleaners have a remote in their pocket, and they walk around the whole time with this remote, and they can report back as they make progress on their duties going around the hotel. The guy who replenishes the minibar may have a remote which he just uses the hotel TV in the same way you can use it for checking out. He goes in and says, okay, this guy's had 3 whiskies or whatever. Then there's a sort of super master control where you do one-off tasks that aren't going to be done on a daily basis. So the engineers who install the TV systems, they come in and they will configure it. They debug it if they're having problems. So you might find commands that bring up those menus. So before you do that, it's useful to check if our assertion earlier that their model is back to front, you know, is there data on this system that you shouldn't be able to see, but the TV is controlling? But can you just bypass that control mechanism? And one of the ways to do it is to use your own tuner. Now, rather than carrying around a TV, you again pop into Saturn and come out with a Halpeg, and this is very important, a Y splitter. So you can leave the original system in place and look at the signal on the back end. Sorry, just checking my power. Something's beeping. Okay, so you may recognize, some of you may recognize this. Here we have the hotel TV, and we've got a side channel looking at the other channels on the system. And, yeah, sure enough, there's a movie which the TV is controlling access to, but it's being broadcast anyway, so you just tune into it. If you're being really cheeky, you can feed it back from the VGA, SVHS back into the TV and watch it on the TV. So. Okay, so we've looked at the remote, and how do we actually find the hidden codes? Well, that was a very big code, 14 bits. 16,000 possible codes. Now, I mean, clearly I'm a sad bastard with too much time on my hands, but even I'm not going to sit through 16,000 code tests. So I want to reduce the search space. And the way we do that is we read all the codes that are on the standard remote, and we look at which bits we know are definitely being used. So we record button presses 0 to 9, and we look at the bits that have changed during that process or have been set. So far, first two bits have been used and the last four bits have been used. And we work our way through all the buttons on the remote until we get to a point where we've tried everything we can actually know, and we're left with the first two bits have been used, four bits are unknown, and the main code as in the last 8 bits. Unfortunately, part of my slide is going off the bottom. I'll see if I can scroll down. No. So what that gives you is 10 bits or 1,024 possible combinations. So what we now need to do is eliminate bits that possibly don't matter. They've been the unknowns and the ones that have been used. So what we're doing here is we take the original command power and we toggle one bit and we see if that command still succeeds. And if it does, there's a good chance that bit's being ignored. We don't actually care. We don't need to try all the combinations of that bit. So we just ignore it. In this case, the second bit failed when we toggled it, so we do have to worry about it. So that gets included in the search space. And again, we work through all the possible bits that we don't know about, which in this case is just these first six. And we end up with the final position in this case that we can forget about bits 1, 3, 4, and 5, and we do have to worry about bit 2 and the last 8 bits. So we have 10 bits, which gives us 1,024 possible codes. So in this case, because some of the bits were at the beginning of the pattern, rather than trying to generate really weird long binary numbers, I just created two sets of patterns which represent those two possible start points and the 8 bits on the end. And then I spit that out to a config file, fire up the transmitter, go through the process, and start sending the codes. And you just sit there and watch for a reaction, see what the TV does. And sure enough, by the time I've finished, I have a whole bunch of codes that do a whole bunch of stuff. So we had some engineering codes. This turned out to be a disabling code. And this is the big one. So now I've got these buttons. What can I do? Well, potentially I can reconfigure the TV. I can change messages. I can assign the TV to another room. When I watch those interesting channels, it appears embarrassingly on someone else's bill. I can say whether the channel's chargeable or not, so it doesn't care. And I can find new channels, which maybe they didn't want me to see. So first thing, of course, you have to do is tag your TV. So now when I switch on, that's what comes up. If you can find that room, I'll give you a prize. And same again. Same again. Okay, the other thing we can do is view back-end, the debugging engineering systems. So, not very interesting. Test signal. Actually, this is interesting. This is some kind of key. It seems to always be there, and I don't know why. It always changes to zero, and unfortunately, it seems to have some side effects like minibar billing disappearing and stuff like that. So. Some debugging information. Some of this you can change. You can go into the fields and you can set them, but obviously effects unknown. You can find back-end systems, some information about what's going on the system. If you know something about the software that's running, maybe that will tell you something useful about other systems in the hotel. Sometimes you just find really bad stuff. Now, this looks fairly harmless, but you'll notice this cursor's appeared. And it turns out that if I move the up and down buttons, the cursor moves. So here's a page which had a link in it. So I move to the link. I click on the link. It takes me to another page. And here's an address with a link on it. And I take... Oh, look. Oops. This one made me laugh. This was browsing the machine. I came across a CD in the master machine drive. And that was... You can also potentially see what other people are doing while they're in the hotel. Most of it is, well, there are children possibly here, so I can't show you, but they do things like reading their webmail, for example. And the reason they do that is because the way the back-end system works is they're assigning channels and then broadcasting them, and they're tuning the TV to the new channel. So sometimes you'll see when you select a service, it says, please wait while we assign a channel, and that's what's happening. So the other thing you can do is access the staff facilities. So you could have a really big party in your room and then mark it clean and DOS yourself. So. And the same party after some adjustment. So then there's the other thing that people go looking for in hotels. Pay-per-view, and there seem to be three or four different ways that this is achieved. True on-demand, basically, that your TV sends a command down the back channel, asks the system to start a movie, and then retunes the TV or unlocks access to that channel. Or you have channels that are just constantly cycling, or they start at fixed time. The movie starts at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, whatever. But again, the controller will tend to reprogram the TV and reroute the signal to that to what you're allowed to watch. So here we've retuned the TV, and we're pretty sure we've hit pay dirt because you've got that kind of cheesy 70s music going on in the background. But they're sending a spoiler signal. You can't actually see the picture. You can hear the sounds, but you can't see the picture. And this is where that special code came in. You send the go away computer command. And sadly, it wasn't very interesting. But basically, that's just shut off the back-end system, so they're not listening anymore. Some cases, it's easier. You go into the setup menu. You tell it to retune. There's that educational channel you were looking for. Okay, so what got me started in this whole thing actually was looking at car unlocking systems, and I moved to looking at TV because it's there, it was easy to get at. I have plenty of time in hotels, nothing to do. So it was nice and easy. And I consider that probably the technology will behave similarly in RF as it does in infrared. In other words, they won't bother doing anything particularly secure because it's an invisible protocol. They're just using RF because it's a better technology. In the case of a car, it was broke. They did need to fix it because it was very directional. You have to point your opener at the car. With RF, you just press the button, and if you're within range. So the question is, the new systems, do they use rolling codes? How good are those rolling codes? How big are the windows? I know they do, in fact, because I used to be able to open my BMW with a Palm Pilot, but I could only do it once. So I'd have to record the unlock code, and then I replayed it, and the car would open, but the next time it would fail. So I was curious to see what those codes are. Strangely, I've been unable over the last year to get hold of a single rolling code infrared car key system in the UK because people just don't use them anymore. So if there's anyone here who has one, please come and see me. One thing I have done is had a quick play with an RF controller. This is a standard two-button RF controller. And I found a way to generate a factory reset signal with this. Or actually, more accurately, my wife socialed a way to generate a factory reset from an engineer when she was stuck in a car park one day. And I was able to test it. I took it home. I tried it. You know, she told me about it. I tried it with my spare key. It did the same thing. A few months later, I was driving with a friend, and he was dropping off a rental car. And I noticed that his fob when he locked the car was the same. So I thought, well, I wonder if it's keyed to my wife's car or it's a generic thing. So let's try it. And, it was late, and I was tired, and I wasn't really thinking. But I don't know if you've ever heard the sound of 100 car doors all opening at the same time. It's scary. So that was it. It's a fairly short talk. If you've got any questions, please, fire away. Don't be embarrassed.
Yeah. Does the Wolf TV thing still works?
Sorry, does the TV thing?
Yeah, in the Caesar's Palace.
As far as I know, I was there in July, August, so...
Fine.
You're planning a trip, then. You'll find most of these systems are fairly standard. What I found is the front-end TVs tend to be the same, but and the back-ends change. So the way you actually attack them in detail changes, but the initial codes, once you have them, to get into the systems are the same. The way the actual back ends work are totally different, though.
So just a little story. I did something equal in Hamburg in a hotel without infrared. I just typed in a URL, I hit somehow the help button and showed up a little message box, page not found. So I entered that URL /cgibin/.. Mm-hmm. And I got the main page, housekeeping, minibar,
excellent.
Add new products, and so on.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot of possibilities with hotel systems where they give you a keyboard. There's a lot where they have internet now, and you'll see there's a little infrared keyboard sitting in front of you. So the potential, once you know the address of the main server to do what I was doing with the mouse pointer, is obviously there.
One funny thing is stickers on the bottom of these keyboards. Warning, not compatible with home equipment, may break it.
I've never seen that. Yeah. Any other questions? No? That's it then. Thank you.